Track one.
Welcome to the East Shropshire Talking Newspaper. And now, over to your presenter.
Hello and welcome to edition 1682, which we're recording on the 28th of October 2025 in our studio situated in the Rican Housing Group's building in Telford. My name is Robert Green and I'm pleased to be back again in the presenting chair. Joining me are our two editor readers, Eve Saunders and Guy King, and our recording engineer is Alan Snell. We have the news readings on tracks 1, 2 and 4, and Dave Gregory will be here with his sports report on track 3. Tracks 5 to 9 contain general features of interest. We must thank the Midland News Association for providing and allowing us to use their digital versions of the following newspapers, which are the Shropshire Star, Telford and Bridgenorth Journals, and the Market Drayton and Newport Advertisers. Other sources of material are acknowledged as and when used. Also, we thank the Royal Mail for delivering our pouches direct to your door. Time now to hear what we have coming up in the first group of news items. There is a council finance emergency. The theme for RAF Cosford's air show is revealed. Help required for an NHS trust. Help also required to choose the official flag for Telford and Wrekin. Wellington Council buys a local bank site. A funeral has been arranged for a Blist Hill volunteer. An appeal has been made for cat adoption by the RSPCA. But first, Eve tells us that community transport groups have been thanked.
A consortium of local community transport groups welcomed a visit from Shropshire Council's portfolio holder for transport and economic growth, Rob Wilson. The visit coincided with Community Transport Week 2025 from October the 13th to the 17th, which this year had a theme of More Than a Minibus, showcasing how community transport services are integral to local lives. During the visit, Councillor Rob Wilson met with staff and volunteers representing the 9 community transport groups operating within Shropshire that form the Shropshire Community Transport Consortium. The consortium explained how their services go beyond transportation, helping individuals stay independent, connected and empowered, whilst also discussing the challenges the groups face. It was fantastic to meet the members of the Shropshire Community Transport Consortium and hear about the work they do across our county, connecting people and places that might otherwise be isolated. With increasing pressure on services across the county, partnership with the voluntary sector will be more and more vital. I want to thank all of the volunteers who keep the wheels turning, said Councillor Wilson. Each community transport group aims to tackle loneliness and social isolation by providing essential services that are more than just transport. They are a lifeline for people across the local community.
Shropshire Council has requested emergency funding from the government as it seeks to avoid financial crisis. The council's Liberal Democrat leaders, who took over the authority from the Conservatives after winning May's local election, have confirmed an official and urgent request to the government for help. The council has asked for what's called exceptional financial support as it seeks to avoid the local government equivalent of bankruptcy, issuing a Section 114 notice. The authority has made no secret of its worsening financial position, declaring a financial emergency last month, but the situation has deteriorated to the point where it now has requested urgent help from the government. Councillor Roger Evans, Shropshire Council's Cabinet Member for Finance, said, "For a number of years now, the council has been overspending its budget, a budget that was set by the previous administration. Reserves or savings that have been used to meet this continued deficit to the extent that now it's all been used up. There's nothing left for us to use to help to meet this shortfall." Councillors and staff have been working hard since May to put in place a number of measures to stop all non-essential spend, reduce essential spend and increase income to try and deliver the needed £60 million of savings that were in the budget we inherited. Due to the severity of this situation, we declared a financial emergency in September. My thanks and apologies to all our dedicated staff who've tried to turn this council around in just a few months. We're in the process of developing a plan to improve, which will help us focus on our people, money and priorities over the next 12 to 18 months. Despite our challenges, I truly believe we can make Shropshire Council sustainable.
The RAF Cosford Air Show has unveiled its official poster and announced the theme for next year's event. The hugely popular show has revealed the 2026 event will be billed Engineering the Future. Set to take place on Sunday, June the 14th, organisers are promising an air show that will offer a dynamic celebration of innovation, aviation excellence and the pioneering spirit of aerospace engineering. The newly released poster, designed to encapsulate the theme, features a dynamic composition of RAF aircraft in motion, evoking a sense of speed, innovation and technological progress. The organisers explained that the abstract art style, layered with geometric shapes, reflects the fusion of tradition and modernity that defines the future of aerospace engineering.
The Health Secretary has pledged further government support for Shropshire's main hospital trust, saying there's still lots more to do to address long-standing failures. Wes Streeting highlighted recent progress made by the Shrewsbury and Telford Hospital NHS Trust during a parliamentary debate on Tuesday. He noted that since last year's general election, the government has helped deliver an additional 94,000 appointments and cut waiting lists by more than 14,000 patients at the Trust. In a question to the Health Secretary, Sean Davis referred to plans for Telford's first ever cancer treatment unit at the Princess Royal. It's hoped that the new service will be up and running by 2029, supplementing existing cancer clinics and services currently based at the Royal Shrewsbury Hospital. Responding, Mr. Streeting acknowledged recent improvements, but admitted there is still more work to do to bring services up to standard. Wes Streeting said, "He's right that local services haven't been good enough for a number of years. We're not going to turn a blind eye to that failure. We're going to do something about it. There's a long way to go, but we've already delivered an extra 94,000 appointments and cut waiting lists by over 14,000 at his local trust since the general election. So a lot done, but lots more to do." The government recently unveiled plans to raise standards in underperforming hospital trusts, including the SATH, through the publication of performance league tables and the delivery of targeted support. It was also revealed recently that waiting times for tests and scans at Shropshire's acute hospitals, RSH and Princess Royal, have significantly improved, as it recorded its best diagnostic performance in more than 5 years. The Trust is now ranked in the top performing 50% of the NH Trusts in England. Waiting for the proportion of patients is less than 6 weeks for a diagnostic test. In July 2025, 82.1% of referred patients were seen within that time frame. Sean Davis, MP for Telford, said, "The challenges we face with NHS services here in Telford are significant. In fact, we have a mountain to climb, and like many of you, me and my family depend on them too. We all deserve better, which is why I continue to raise these concerns at the highest levels and push for the improvements Telford urgently needs, whether in the House of Commons or in meetings with the Health Minister and health bosses. We're beginning to see signs of progress, and our NHS staff continue to do an incredible job day in and day out. Thankfully, the Health Secretary shares my commitment. We know there's a long way to go, but both I and the government will keep fighting for the higher standards that Telford and the wider Shropshire deserve."
Residents are being invited to help choose the official flag of Telford and Wrekin, with four final designs inspired by schoolchildren now going to a public vote. More than 1,000 schoolchildren from across the borough took part in a flag design competition earlier this year, and judges have now whittled down the entries to the final four designs. An online poll opened this week, giving residents the chance to select their favourite design to represent Telford and Wrekin. The vote will remain open until Sunday, November the 2nd. Teachers will also be submitting votes on behalf of their pupils, which will be counted alongside the public vote to determine the winning design. Councillor Lee Carter, leader of Telford and Wrekin Council, praised the creativity shown by local school children and encouraged residents to get involved in the final stage of the competition. He said, "All of the children who took part in our competition have done fantastically well, and the four finalists deserve special praise for their work, which has inspired the designs for the final flags." And he added, "We've got so much to be proud of, both nationally and locally in Telford and Wrekin. I hope people will take part in the public vote to choose the flag they feel best represents the borough." The four young finalists worked with a professional designer to transform their original drawings into official flag concepts, following Flag Institute guidelines. The rules include keeping designs simple, using meaningful symbolism, and limiting colours to two or three basic shades. But then the rest is down to the pupils' imagination and creativity. Residents can view the four shortlisted designs and cast their vote online via Telford and Wrekin Council's website.
Wellington Council has bought the former Halifax building in the town centre, a meeting has been told. Details of how much the town council has paid for the building in Duke Street remained confidential, but when it hit the market earlier this year, it had a freehold sale price of £250,000. Councillor Paul Davis made the announcement at the full council meeting on October the 14th. "It's an absolute pleasure to announce that the town council has become a landlord in waiting. We've managed to secure the Halifax building," he said. Councillor Davis also revealed some of the strategy behind the decision to secure a major asset in the town centre. "The town council wants to try to see if the post office, which is adjoined to the market in Market Street, will want to move from there to the building in Duke Street. Duke Street purchase also includes a small unit next door, a car park at the rear and floors above." Councillor Davis said, "We have the position where we can try to enter negotiations and see if the post office will relocate to that building." He added that there'll be a lot of discussions ahead, but that ultimately is the ambition.
A woman who spent 27 years wearing period costume while educating and entertaining visitors to a Shropshire museum is the first person in modern times to have her funeral at the site's chapel. Pat Robinson from Horse Hay recently died unexpectedly at the age of 88. She was a familiar face to visitors of Bliss Hill Victorian Town in Telford, having been a volunteer there for around 27 years. She spent her days dressed in Victorian costume while educating the thousands of visitors who descend on the museum each year. Following her death, Pat's family said they wanted to do something special for her and arranged for her funeral to be held at the Museum Mission Church last week, the first time it had been used for a funeral service in modern times. Granddaughter Kelly Wixon said her nan, who was originally from the Black Country, loved the museum. She was there around 27 years up until COVID, and it was her favourite place to be. As a Christian, she loved giving her talks about the Mission Church at the museum and where it came from. "We have the best childhood memories in Bliss Hill, doing the shoe shining, walking on stilts, double Dutch skipping with my sisters and cousins. And Nan loved taking us there dressing up as Victorian kids. My sister also had her wedding party in the Forest Glen 9 years ago, so Bliss Hill is very close for the family." She said they had never discussed with Pat about her funeral arrangements, as she passed away quite unexpectedly. "When I was little, I remember her saying the church was a working church and could have weddings and funerals, although there hasn't been one there for many years, until now. I think she would have loved that. The staff were absolutely brilliant and helped make it all possible. We can't thank them all enough, as well as L. Tranter and Sons funeral directors and Pastor Giles Higgins. Bliss Hill will always hold a special place in all of our hearts."
The RSPCA has issued an urgent appeal for adopters as the number of cats in its care has reached an all-time high. The charity says the number of cats waiting for homes at any one time has more than doubled, from around 800 in 2020 to approximately 1,700 this summer. Records also show that cats are now waiting an average of 40 days to find a home, up from 32 days in September last year. With thousands of cats being cared for, including at Gonsall Farm Animal Centre in Dorrington near Shrewsbury, the charity has launched its Adoptober campaign this month to encourage people to give rescue cats a loving home. Among those waiting for their forever home at RSPCA Gonsall Farm Animal Centre are Mars, Elsa, Orville and Blackjack. Mars is around 6 to 12 months old and one of the centre's longest residents. Supervisor Alice Batchelor Reynolds said that she can't believe he's still searching for a home. She said, "This adorable boy is a bundle of joy, brimming with energy and a playful spirit. Mars loves getting up to mischief and is guaranteed to bring endless entertainment to your home. He's full of so much love and affection, and he will happily sit in your arms purring and kneading away at you." The RSPCA said Mars would thrive in a household with children and could live with another cat. Elsa, who came to RSPCA Nossal Farm when her owner died, would prefer a quiet, rural home without dogs. Blackjack, described as a lovely lad, is looking for a calm household with older children aged 13 and above. "Blackjack's a quiet soul who loves a fuss and a head bump," said Alice. "Blackjack would prefer a quiet home with lots of safe hidey holes as he enjoys feeling secure in a snuggly space. He'll still roll around and loves a fuss in those spaces, though." Meanwhile, 4-year-old Orville is full of character and arrived at Gonsall Farm with his friend Keith. Alice said, "He loves a good fuss and playing with his toys. Orville came in with his friend Keith, and although they rub along okay together, we feel Orville may prefer to be the star of his own show." Those interested can fill out an online application form.
Track 2. East Shropshire Talking Newspaper recently attended an exhibition at the Barnabas Church in Shrewsbury called Hide, that's H-I-D-E, with the object of bringing people and support together. The exhibition was opened by the Mayor of Shrewsbury, Alex Wagner, and I had the opportunity to meet him when he came to our stand.
Good afternoon, sir. Do I call you sir? Mr. Mayor?
I think Alex is fine, you know. I'm quite happy with that.
You've got some lovely work on your suit here. You've got some medals, is it, or where?
Well, these are the links of the wards of Shrewsbury. So these are Underdale and Sutton and Raybrook and all the parts of the town that link together. Though I've represented two seats on the council, Baybrook and Quarry, and because of when this was made back in the 70s, neither of those actually existed. So I'm carrying around everyone else's places actually, rather than my own home. But it's one of two chains we have in Shrewsbury. We keep one tucked away in the museum. It's rather old and falling apart, and rather more impressive than the one I've got on right now, but this one's rather good if you're going out and about in the community and going and meeting lovely people, which is what I'm doing right now.
Does it rattle when you walk around or not?
There's a bit of a clank. I often get asked if it's heavy, and I think that you get very used to it very quickly, like with anything, but then you take it off if you've been wearing it for sort of 4, 5, 6 hours out and about, and you go, crikey, have I been wandering around wearing that? It's good for exercise, though, I imagine. You know, it can only be good. I never played rugby, but if I did, I imagine it would have come in handy.
And can I ask you how you became to be mayor of Shrewsbury?
Yeah, so the way the mayoralty works is it's the most senior councillor in terms of longest serving. I'm the youngest we've ever had. I'm 25, but the sort of succession is based on who's served the longest. So I got elected 5 years ago now, or nearly 5 years ago, and there's been quite a lot of political tumultion. The mayoralty is neutral, but that's a statement of fact, and what that means is we have a lot of new councillors, and actually the youngest and newest council we've ever had in Shrewsbury. So I got offered the chance to do it and thought, you know, it's a bit like captaining your local football team or going to the World Cup, isn't it? So absolutely go for it. And yeah, it's great. You only get a year, so you've got to make the most of it. But we've tried to make it high visibility, raise money for two brilliant charities, which is West Mercia Search and Rescue and Shrewsbury Street Pastors, who keep the town centre safe, which is a big passion of mine. And I think we've been keeping it in the news and relevant and, you know, still traditional, but, you know, relevant to what people are interested in nowadays.
So you must go to lots of events that you have planned.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, the most people have done in modern times is sort of like 300 or 400. I think we're a lot lower than that now. I think COVID may have had an impact on the amount of things, but yes. we'll do 150 or so local events this year,
really?
Plus a number of other fundraisers and keeping active. So it's a busy diary. It's a busy job, but It's great. It's the best job I've ever had. You know, I mean, compared to sitting in an office from 9 till 5, it's an awful lot better.
Is it very tiring?
I've got a high social battery, so I've got a high pain threshold maybe for the... I know some people's idea of hell would be, you know, first thing in the morning till first thing at night chatting to people, but I'm very happy doing that and enjoy it. You do sometimes get home and kind of collapse, but, you know, people work in mines and serve in the military, and I think it's rather silly to complain about my lot when I'm getting to go around lovely community events in my hometown. I think it's a pretty great job, really.
Well, it's lovely to see you here, and thank you for talking to us.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Tom Kane is the man running the exhibition, and I caught up with him at the end of the proceedings.
Hi, mate.
On your front, you've got Hyde. Tell me, what does Hyde mean?
Hyde means Hidden Illness and Disability Exhibition. And the idea behind it is to get all the groups that look after, support groups that look after hidden disabilities like hearing, like cancer, like ADHD, all the different mental things. What I'm trying to do is trying to get all these support groups together so we can all link up and help the disabled community. So that's basically the background behind it.
Has there been much hard work in the background to get it ready?
Yeah, I think it's probably self-induced, because I think what it is that with Christine, Debbie and myself, we thought we could do it by ourselves, and it's too much hard work trying to get the publicity. The one we've run today in Shrewsbury, it's been really good. It's been lots of networking, but we haven't had anybody from off the street, so we need to look at that and try and work out how we can get more advertising and get it more noticed to the public.
And this is it the second or the third one you've done?
This is the second one this year. We did one in Telford. That was as similar, but the thing is, one in Telford, I thought the idea in January and tried to run it in March, so but we're running it again next year.
Yes, yeah. Well, we'll look forward to going to that exhibition. You've had quite a few stands here, haven't you, this morning?
Yeah, we're very lucky. Yeah, we had people that turn up. We've got the NHS, we've got Community Resource, we've got Shropshire Hard of Hearing, we've got Sight Loss Shropshire, we've got Deaf and Able. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's okay, but please, can I get some more? I'd love to get some more. And it was really nice for the mayor to turn up.
Yes, he was a very pleasant nice gentleman, wasn't he? Yes.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you very much for
talking to us.
Thank
you, Rob. Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Well, the next Hyde exhibition will take place on the 12th of March 2026 at Hazeldine House, Central Square, Telford. And we'll keep you informed nearer the date. The majority of our listeners are able to listen to our ESTN recordings by means of the memory sticks, which are sent out in the post. There are other ways we can be heard, for example, by dialing our phone number 01952 935 936 from any landline or mobile. These calls are chargeable, but won't cost any more per minute than a local standard rate call. If you wish, you can tune in and hear us by visiting our website, www.eastshropshiretn.co.uk. Apple service users can listen via Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and Apple's home smart speaker. You can phone us on 01952 373 007, and please speak clearly and slowly and leave your contact number so we can get back to you. Our phone number is continually monitored. If you prefer to send us an email, our address is eastshropshiretn@gmail.com. And alternatively, you can send us a message via the contact form on our website. Full details can be found on our website. Our Facebook page can be found at www.facebook.com if you're a social media user. Right, let's go back to our newsroom for some more stories. An athletics club head coach wins an award. There is a British Legion poppy appeal. Councillors are split over brick bus shelters. a poppy fall has been created in support of a village church. Furrows creates a deal to support a girls' soccer team. Aldi creates a winter food fund. The Seven Valley Repair Team is nominated for an award. But before that, Guy reads about water shortages at reservoirs.
Severn Trent has admitted it is facing a water shortfall this October, after reservoir levels dipped back below half capacity this week. Despite rainfall across the region in recent weeks, including heavy downpours and flood warnings across Shropshire, water storage levels have remained low. On Monday, the overall water storage level across Severn Trent's reservoirs fell to 49.8%, and that's down from 51.5% on October the 13th and 52.9% the week before. The company's reservoirs have a maximum capacity of 247 billion litres, but as of Monday, they only held 123 billion. Reservoir levels have been in steady decline following a prolonged dry summer, during which residents were urged to be thoughtful about their water use throughout the warmer months. Levels first fell below 50% in September and have since hovered around the halfway mark. By contrast, on October the 21st last year, water storage stood at 82.2%, and the first recording for that month was at 75.8%. In its latest weather and drought report covering the week of October the 10th to the 16th, the Environment Agency said the West Midlands remains in drought. The weather report showed there was less than a millimetre of rainfall recorded in most areas in that period. Severn Trent officials said there's less water in reservoirs than hoped for at this time of year, and urged residents to continue to remain water-wise. Doug Clark, Water Resources Planning Lead at Severn Trent, is urging people to be careful all the year round. He said, "We've seen some rain in recent weeks, but it's easy to forget that we had the driest spring on record, and the annual rainfall this year is way below what we normally see. At many of our sites, reservoir levels are improving, but we do have less water than we would want in some of our reservoirs at this time of year. With climate change, experts say drought like we experienced this year could happen more often, and that's why it's important we all do our bit to help reservoirs refill over the winter. And that's why we would encourage everybody to keep being careful all the year round, not just in the summer. By doing so, they can help the environment and save themselves money if they have a meter, or even through their energy usage on hot water." Reservoir levels briefly rose on September the 22nd, marking the first increase since February. The Environment Agency said significant rainfall over sustained periods will be needed to return water levels to normal for this time of year. Its report stated, despite improving conditions in the northwest England due to recent rainfall, drought risks in part of the southeast continue to increase. It's been a very dry week across England, with less than a millimetre received in most regions. This means October rainfall has been low, with England having received only a quarter of the long-term average. Overall reservoir storage for England has decreased. Above average rainfall in September has brought improvements or stabilisation in the water situation for some companies, but further significant rainfall over a sustained period is needed to return to normal conditions.
The head coach at a historic Shropshire athletics club has won a regional award. Camilla Stewart, head coach at Wenlock Olympians Athletics Club, has won the West Midlands Regional Volunteer Coach of the Year award. Organised by England Athletics, the governing body for athletics in England, the award was presented at the Regional Volunteer Awards at the Alexander Stadium in Birmingham. Camilla was nominated by members of the steering group of Wenlock Olympians Athletic Club, which trains at the Leisure Centre, William Brooks School in Much Wenlock. The submission was supported by fellow coaches, athletes and parents who contributed both towards her nomination and a video which was shown as part of the awards evening. Started in 1950, the club is located in Much Wenlock, thought by many to be the birthplace of the modern Olympic movement. Games were founded in the Shropshire town in 1850 by William Brooks, who inspired Pierre de Coubertin to create the International Olympic Committee. Ian Dadswell, chair of the Wenlock Olympian Athletics Club steering group, said Camilla had transformed the club through tireless dedication and inspirational coaching. Camilla has coached at the club for over 10 years. During the past year in particular, she has led the club on a remarkable journey from being the sole qualified coach to building a thriving club with three additional qualified coaches offering specialised sessions across multiple disciplines. Her personalised approach has helped athletes flourish, including one para-athlete now competing nationally. Wenlock Olympians Athletics Club, part of Wenlock Olympian Society, is a junior club of around 30 athletes. Jonathan Edwards, world triple jump record holder and president of the Wenlock Olympian Society, congratulated Camilla, saying, "Well done, Camilla, a great asset to the Wenlock Olympians Athletics Club." To be awarded Volunteer Coach of the Year for the West Midlands region is quite an achievement and well deserved. From my own experience, I know that the value of a good coach cannot be underestimated. It makes a real difference to your mindset and your performance. The Society is working to raise £85,000 towards the track's renovation so the facilities can continue to be used by the club, school and the wider community and include athletics in the Wenlock Olympian Games.
A spotlight is being shone on efforts to rebuild the lives of veterans whose lives have fallen apart for this year's Royal British Legion annual poppy appeal. At any given moment, the Legion is helping more than 7,000 members of the armed forces community with expert advice and practical support. This year's appeal, launched yesterday, aims to raise more than £50 million. Lucy Inskip, the Legion's poppy appeal director, said, "Every day, ex-service personnel and their families come to the Royal British Legion for support when they become overwhelmed with issues including addiction, debt, homelessness, PTSD and relationship breakdowns. When something goes wrong, the RBL is there to help rebuild lives and provide members of the armed forces community with the support they need to create a better future. The lasting impact of a training accident, loss of a friend or battlefield trauma are among the range of potentially devastating issues faced by some veterans." Mazinskip described the annual appeal, founded in 1921, as something that brings the nation together and helps us raise vital funds needed to support the armed forces community.
Two prominent brick bus shelters in Donington will be torn down and replaced with modern versions, Telford and Wrekin Council has confirmed. The shelters on opposite sides of Wrekin Drive at the parade have served the community for years, but they have attracted unsavoury and antisocial behaviour, a meeting heard. A councillor this week said she thought it was a damn shame to lose a part of the area's heritage, but others want them replaced with modern, see-through stops with a living roof. Donington and Muxton Parish Council had previously agreed to hand over the two bus stops at the parade to Telford and Wrekin Council. Councillor Ollie Vickers, Labour, Donington, is a parish councillor as well as being the cabinet member for the economy and transport at the borough. He said that the enclosed nature of brick-built shelters makes them more susceptible to antisocial behaviour. Councillor Jenny Urie, Muxton, told the parish council meeting that these bus stops are a part of our history, including when it was a garrison town in the 1930s. "I think it's a damn shame if we do get rid of them."
A cascade of thousands of handmade poppies has been knitted and stitched together to create a remembrance waterfall display for a village church. The vibrant red poppies crafted by residents from Basschurch have been strung together to form a striking poppy fall that will hang from the tower of All Saints Church in time for next month's remembrance commemorations. The new display replaces an original poppy fall that was made in 2018 to mark the centenary of the end of the First World War, and that has since deteriorated. The idea and project was led by local resident Pauline McKee, who approached the rector of All Saints Church, the Reverend Prebendary Linda Cox, to ask if she could help create a new tribute. With her support, Pauline set about rallying the village and beyond to take part, Several social events were held where residents gathered to craft poppies, with some donating wool, buttons, or money to buy materials and new netting for the display. The finished poppy fall will be officially installed on Saturday, November the 1st at 10 a.m, with help from the Baschurch Fire Station team as part of their ladder training and community service. North Shropshire MP Helen Morgan is also expected to attend the unveiling.
Car firm Furrows has reaffirmed its commitment to supporting girls' football at the grassroots level with a new partnership with Shropshire FA. As part of its ongoing sponsorship of the Shropshire Girls League, Furrows will expand its support to help accelerate growth, inclusion and development opportunities for young female players, coaches and referees across the county. Reflecting the national trend, Shropshire is currently seeing strong growth in girls' and women's participation in football. There are approximately 2,500 women and girls registered, with over 1,000 grassroots clubs in Shropshire, accounting for around 20% of all participants. The FA's Find Football portal has seen a 62.5% rise in inquiries for girls' football sessions in July compared to June this year, as the excitement around the Women's Euros and the Lionesses' latest triumph sparked a wave of interest among girls and their families. Furrow's sponsorship is helping fund league operations for the Shropshire Girls League, ensuring more fixtures, better equipment and resources for teams, development opportunities for coaches and referees to increase the number of trained female volunteers in these roles, and community outreach to encourage more girls to take up football and reduce dropout, especially in teenage years. Anthony Frost, director and dealer principal at Furrows, said, "We believe in the power of sport to build confidence, teamwork and opportunity. Seeing so many girls across Shropshire choosing to play football is inspiring, but there is more we can do. Our continued support means every girl who wants to be part of the game should have the chance." Andy Weston, CEO of Shropshire FA, added, "Girls' football in Shropshire is thriving, and partnerships like the one we have with Furrows are vital to sustaining that momentum." And he added, "Together, we're making sure football is truly a game for all."
Aldi is inviting shoppers in Shropshire to nominate local charities, community groups and food banks across the UK to receive a share of its winter fund. The supermarket's winter fund will see it donate £10,000 to charities nationwide in an effort to support those most in need in the lead-up to Christmas. A panel of Aldi representatives will review nominations, with the chosen organisations each receiving a cash donation to continue their vital work during the busy winter months. To put forward a charity, shoppers simply need to email aldiwinterfund@citypress.co.uk, including the name and location of the organisation, as well as a short summary of why they need support. Liz Fox, National Sustainability Director at Aldi UK, said, "We know the winter period can be an incredibly challenging time for many people across the country, and that's why we've relaunched our Winter Fund initiative. The response to last year's call was amazing, and as a result we were able to support lots of incredible charities with their work across the UK. We're pleased to be able to help even more organisations this year as they head into the winter months. Entries close on Monday, November the 10th.
The Severn Valley Railway has been shortlisted for 3 national awards, including one for the team that repaired a major landslip, which closed part of its line for months. The Heritage Railway has been announced as a finalist in 3 categories at this year's prestigious Rail Staff Awards. In its first ever entry to the competition, the Severn Valley Railway has been shortlisted in Project Team or Person Award, the Moorbrook Bridge Team, Rail Engineer of the Year, Anthony Bartlam, and Rail Ambassador of the Year, the Severn Valley Railway's Managing Director, Jonathan Gus Dunster. Anthony Bartlam played a key role in the Moorbrook Bridge repair project. In January, a serious landslip at the Moorbrook Bridge left part of the Severn Valley Railway's track between Bridge North and Hampton Lode suspended in mid-air and impassable. The railway was unable to operate services from Bridge North for several months. Repairs were completed in late July, marked by a special reopening event featuring the world-famous Flying Scotsman. Now, the team responsible for the restoration will go head-to-head with some of the biggest names in the UK rail industry at the awards. This is the very first time the Severn Valley Railway has entered the Rail Staff Awards, so to reach the finals in all three of our nominated categories is absolutely incredible, said Leslie Carr, the Severn Valley Railway's head of communications. We're flying the flag for the heritage sector and showing that the professionalism, skills and passion here at the Severn Valley Railway are on a par with the wider rail industry. The shortlisting process was determined through a public vote, and the Severn Valley Railway has expressed heartfelt thanks to everyone who supported its nominations. We've been overwhelmed by the support from our visitors, members and volunteers, Leslie added. It means so much to know that people value what we do and have helped us on our way to the finals. The winners will be announced at a ceremony on November 27th.
Track 3. It's time now to bring on Dave Gregory, who has been poring over the newspapers so he can update you with what's been happening on the sports front. Over to you, Dave.
Hello, everybody. Well, once again, in the soccer matches played last weekend, Shropshire's two senior teams made progress, but unfortunately, Wolves remained pointless at the foot of the Premier League. AFC Telford United have just completed 3 games in 8 days and acquired 7 points after beating 16th-placed Worksop Town 2-1 last Saturday, the 25th of October. The books look a better side now, and Cordan should have taken the lead in the first few minutes. The Villagers began to find their way into the game and scored in the 23rd minute. Telford then lost star central defender Oliver Cawthorne to injury and had to regroup. When Worksop's goalie brought down Charlie Williams, Telford striker Matty Stenson scored from the penalty spot, and that was his 51st goal for the club. 7 minutes of the second half, a good move down the left resulted in Jimmy Meadows' cross being turned into his own net by a Worksop defender. Well, they all count, don't they? Telford worked hard for a clinching third goal without success, and it was Worksop who twice went close in the closing stages before Telford substitute Rhys Hilton went close, but the final score was 2-1 to Telford, and after that game, Telford were 14th out of 24 clubs in the National League North. Next time they're up against Sutton United away in the FA Cup first round, and that's this coming Saturday. At 8th from bottom, Oldham Athletic, 3 times the woodworks saved Shrewsbury Town in the first half as the home side carved Town apart. Somehow, the score was still 0-0 at half-time, and Town manager Michael Appleton had some stern words for his players during the interval. As a result, Shrewsbury came out flying in the second half, and within 1 minute, Town went ahead with a fantastic shot from winger Anthony Scully, following a swift counter-attack. 5 minutes later, Oldham equalised, and the game was generally quite chaotic in that second half. In the 91st minute, Shrewsbury took a surprise lead when superb winger Ismail Kabir cut the ball back for young midfielder Tommy McDermott to score with a deflected shot. It wasn't to prove the winner, however, as Oldham equalised with a header in the 95th minute. So 2-2 was the final score in that League Two match, and Shrewsbury were fourth from bottom in the table after that game. It was also a 95th minute goal when visitors fifth from bottom Burnley won the match against Wolves at Molineux last Sunday. The newly promoted Burnley took the lead following some terrible Wolves defending in the 14th minute. Burnley's second goal came in the 30th minute after another bad mistake by a Wolves defender. Wolves then got into some good attacking areas but looked clueless in front of goal. In the 42nd minute, Wolves striker Larson converted a penalty, and 3 minutes later, Wolves were level through Monetzi's header after good work from Bellegarde and Larson. Wolves had more of the ball in the second half and created the better openings, but it was Burnley who took all 3 points with a goal in the 95th minute. At the final whistle, the Wolves fans made their feelings known amid an angry Molyneux atmosphere. 2-3 was the final score, and Wolves are still bottom on 2 points. Just above them are West Ham United on 4 points and Nottingham Forest on 5 points. And in the next game, Wolves will be away to the next team up the table. That is Fulham, who are on 8 points. So, come on, Wolves, you can do better than that. Let's look now at local junior soccer matches played last Saturday, 25th of October. In the Midlands Football League Division 1, AFC Bridge North had a good 4-1 win at 7th and bottom Ingles, and AF Bridge North a 6th. In the North West Counties League First Division South, Telford Town won 2-1 at Barnton. Hormond lost 1-4 at home to Foley Mayor. Shawbury United were thrashed 7-0 at New Mills, and Market Drayton Town drew 1-1 at Stockport Georgians. The latest result I have from Ludlow Town, who currently have selection problems with players not being available, is that on Tuesday evening, the 21st of October, they beat Easington Sports Development 5-1 at home in a Wiseman Lighting floodlit cup tie. Now to women's soccer. When Whitchurch Allport played AFC Telford United in West Midlands League Division 1 North, Whitchurch secured their first win of the season 2-1, and the Telford ladies suffered their first league defeat of the season, and that was on the 19th of October. Shropshire League Premier Division leaders Shrewsbury, up-and-comers, maintained their 100% record with a 7-3 demolition of Worthen Juniors. Second place Dorley Town Lionesses won 4-2 at Newport. Third place Shawbury United beat Ellesmere Rangers 3-0. Allscott Heath demolished Wrekin Juniors 6-0. And Shropshire Lions and Prees United held each other to a 1-1 draw. Turning to other sports, Tony Lloyd from Telford has earned a place in England's new golf disability performance squad, which could lead to international competition. The 49-year-old was born with a condition that left him with extremely short arms and no hands. But Tony, who took up the sport as a 5-year-old, has developed his own swing and gone on to be a superb golfer with a handicap of 8.8. He uses specially lengthened clubs to play the sport and puts the club under his arm in order to swing. A chance meeting as a teenager with a therapist in London, who happened to be a golfer, resulted in Tony learning to swing the ball and helped him on his way in the sport. He's even worked with well-known professionals and appeared on television. Now perhaps international competition beckons. Well, let's hope it does, and good luck to him. Now to catch up on the local rugby union scene. An impressive first-half defensive display paved the way for Bridge North's 22-11 home win over Dudley Kings Winsford on Saturday the 18th of October. And with more possession after the break, Bridge North went on to secure back-to-back wins in Regional 1 Midlands. In the same league, Newport let their standard slip as they suffered a 36-29 defeat at home to Lutterworth. A poor patch in the first 20 minutes of the second half allowed the visitors to take the game away from the hosts, who were knocked off top spot. In Regional 2, Midlands West, Ludlow climbed into the top four after a hard-fought 20-19 success away to second-placed Edwardians. Now, last week, we featured motorcycle racer Tom Booth Amos of Newport and his quest to finish in the World Supersport Championships in the top three places. Well, we can now reveal that at Spain's Circuito de Jerez on Sunday the 19th of October, he finished that event in a thrilling fashion to take second place, but with his Spanish rival winning the race, Tom had to settle for fourth place overall in the 2025 standings. Finally, a summary of other sports news. Woer have been promoted to the Shropshire Premier Bowling League after winning a thrilling playoff final against Horsehay at Monkmoor earlier this month. 22-year-old Shifnal boxer Jacob Lloyd, who began his professional career last March with a great victory, tasted defeat at Wolverhampton in a close contest with fellow unbeaten prospect Craig Nelson of Nottinghamshire. In the final round of the SB Sports Injuries series of 10-mile time trials, Golden Boy cyclist Thomas Hales of Reakin Sport won in 21 minutes 33 seconds on the Waters Upton to Hodnett circuit to secure also this season's championship trophy. On the noted Burway Hill climb near Church Stretton, Bridgenorth's James Souter won the final race of the season in 5 minutes 13 seconds 0.01 to win both the junior title and the overall one as well. So well done to all of those. Telford Tigers ice hockey team inflicted just a second defeat of the season on NIHL National League leaders Swindon Wildcats on Sunday the 19th of October. The 4-3 win, after being 2-0 down, saw Tigers bounce back from a 7-5 defeat at Milton Keynes Lightning on the Saturday the 18th. So on that exceptional, or that probably exciting note, should I say, that's all the sports news for this time. So, as always, thank you for listening, and bye-bye. Until next time.
Track 4. Well, thank you, Dave, and we hope to have you back again next week. We return to the news desk for the final selection of items from the newspapers. A craft centre is pleading for more volunteers. The SVR Christmas treats include planned new services. Marmite and Cheese Banger wins award. An Ice Age exhibit comes to a local zoo. A petanque at centre gets new pieces. Digital exclusion is highlighted for certain groups. A wildlife charity founder is to give a talk. There's to be an Agatha Mr. Men collaboration. To start, though, Guy tells us about a new McDonald's store in Bridgenorth.
Bridgenorth has got its own McDonald's for the first time. The new restaurant was officially opened yesterday after months of planning and building work. The restaurant, which was first announced back in 2023, has been eagerly anticipated. Work on the building started in August. The development is at the Chartwell Business Park and part of a larger development that will see the creation of two units, the other set to be a new Starbucks. The restaurant will be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. A McDonald's franchisee and the man behind Bridgenorth's Golden Arches, Ash Raju, said he was thrilled that the new restaurant was now open, with nearly 100 new jobs created. He said, "I'm incredibly proud to say that we've employed 93 people, of which 95% are local people in the area. And as I said, I'm really proud to offer that." Mr. Raju, who owns 5 other McDonald's restaurants in Shropshire, added, "We're so excited to be here and to be welcomed by all the people in Bridgenorth. And we look forward to hosting you soon and seeing you." It's not taken long since construction started on the new McDonald's, with work beginning only back in August, and the first cheeseburgers going out yesterday. Plans for the Chartwell site received significant backing, with more than 600 people writing letters of support.
A Shropshire craft centre that works with adults with physical and mental difficulties is seeking more volunteers. The Crows Mill Craft Centre in Quat near Bridgenorth was set up as a community interest company around 12 years ago and works with schools and other organisations providing support to vulnerable people. It offers classes in woodworking, blacksmithing, bricklaying, plastering, welding and jewellery making, among other activities, to people with physical disabilities, learning difficulties, mental health issues and disaffected youths. Now the centre is seeking volunteers to help out. A spokesperson for the craft centre said they were looking for people to support people with craft activities, help run the workshop, help maintain the therapeutic garden, lead cooking sessions, as well as help with the administration of the centre. Anybody who has spare time and can assist is urged to telephone 01746 781 942 or email enquiries@crowsmillcraftcentre.co.uk.
Work is well underway to transform the Severn Valley Railway for the festive season, as the Heritage Railway prepares to host 2 brand new Christmas services. This year, the railway is hosting 2 brand new Christmas services for the festive period in collaboration with the Wise Owl Theatre Company. Services are due to start on November the 29th, with the Elf Express departing from Bridgnorth Station and Santa's Steam Special Head starting out from the Kidderminster Station. The Kidderminster service will whisk passengers away to Arley Station for the Great Christmas Train Rescue, a live theatre show featuring inspiring puppetry courtesy of Warhorse designers Matthew Forbes. Chris Brooks, artistic director at Wise Owl Theatre, shared a photograph showing work going on behind the scenes to transform the service for the festive season. Chris said, "Wow, we can't give too much away just yet. Our team has been hard at work creating something truly magical. These glimpses show only the bare bones of what's to come. Soon those wooden panels will be transformed into a festive world full of wonder, colour and a few surprises. We can't wait for audiences to step into the story and see the transformation for themselves." Lewis Maddox, the railway's visitor engagement manager, said, "Hey, the excitement's really building as we see the sets take shape. Clearly our visitors are just as thrilled as we are, with tickets this year selling faster than ever. We're so proud to be partnered with Wise Owl Theatre to deliver something completely fresh and full of festive magic." The Santa Steam Specials and the Elf Express both run on weekends from the 29th of November and on Christmas Eve. And they're also offering relaxed Santa Special train services on December the 7th, 14th and 21st. Book at svr.co.uk.
People may love it or hate it, but judges of a prestigious sausage contest were clearly Marmite fans, as a Shropshire butcher's shop scooped more awards. Morgan's Country Butchers of Waters Upton near Newport won two gongs at the National Craft Butchers Awards held at Harper Adams University. The Shropshire family firm, which was up against an array of the finest butchers from up and down the country, won the Judge's Choice Trophy for its Gloucester Old Spot sausage and the Innovative Sausage category for its Marmite and Cheese sausage. The sausages are the creation of Master Butcher Darren Morgan, ably assisted by daughter Lauren and the rest of the team. Lauren said of the Marmite and Cheese sausage, "It was a risky one to put in because clearly there is a divide, but customers got behind it, so we thought we'd go for it. It's a team effort. Once a month, the whole team get together and we think, what new sausage could we make? What's trendy? What's seasonal? What's going on at that time of year? Dad's the expert with the pork. He's like a magician. We had a few tests and then we said, that's our new sausage." Morgan's has been a prominent butcher's in the county and beyond for many years, with Darren and Lauren appearing on This Morning with Philip Schofield and Holly Willoughby a few years ago after winning Britain's Best Sausage and meeting with the Hairy Bikers. Lauren added, "We like to showcase what we do for the industry to encourage people to go to their local butchers to show they can get something different and it tastes much better."
A genuine woolly mammoth tusk discovered on the European continent close to the North Sea has gone on public display at a county zoo. The real fossil tusk, dating back tens of thousands of years, offers visitors to Telford's Hoo Zoo and Dinosaur World a rare chance to come face to face with a piece of Ice Age history. The arrival of the tusk is the latest addition to the zoo's growing collection of prehistoric-themed attractions and educational exhibits. The pointed arrival comes just a year after the Hoo Zoo and Dinosaur World opened The Land of the Beasts, an immersive walk-through area featuring life-sized animatronic Ice Age creatures alongside the zoo's real-life Eurasian lynx. The area has proven hugely popular with guests, offering a unique blend of living animals and ancient giants brought back to life through technology. Earlier this year, Hoo Zoo also opened Prehistoric Park HQ, a new exhibition combining genuine fossils with props from the hit TV series Nigel Marvin's Prehistoric Park. Zoo owner Will Dorrell said, "We're absolutely thrilled to be able to display a real woolly mammoth tusk. It's a fascinating and tangible link to the Ice Age, a period that continues to captivate audiences both young and old."
Three purpose-built petanque pistes have been created at Lillishall National Sports Centre, offering accessible and low-impact sporting opportunities, free of charge, to local community groups. The project was a partnership between Lillishall National Sports Centre, Telford building firm McPhillips, and Shrewsbury-based engineers WSP, with the Peasts set to be the new permanent home of two flourishing local sports groups, the U3A and a Parkinson's support group. Work to develop the site was carried out and project managed by McPhillips over two busy weeks, with all plant and materials donated by local businesses. Weekly petanque sessions have been held at Lillishall over the last 2 years, but in an area prone to flooding and where access is difficult for people with limited mobility. McPhillips were brought on board by WSP after the National Sports Centre sought partners to help create a new dedicated all-weather facility with wheelchair access. At an official opening, Newport U3A member and the driving force behind the project, Vicky Evans, cut a ribbon, watched by Andrew Dunham of McPhillips, Catherine Bright of WSP, and fellow players.
Despite advances in technology, many people in the county are still being digitally excluded, so health bosses have been told. At two scrutiny meetings this week, Councillor Dawn Hoosman, the Reform UK leader in Shropshire, highlighted that despite her 85-year-old mother being fine with technology up to the age of 82, that has now decreased as her health needs have increased. "It's really important to me that in every decision we're making, these people are helped and are included as things change for them over time," said Ms. Hoosman. Lynn Corley, Chief Officer of Health Watch Shropshire, added, "Yes, we can train people if they want to be trained, but at some point we will unfortunately all lose the ability to use technology, and then what do we do?" Councillor Rosie Radford, Lib Dems, Ellesmere Urban, who was chairing a health overview and scrutiny committee on Monday, said that while a lot of work is going on to support people virtually rather than in person, we still need to bang that drum of there being a cultural ability and geographical aspect to digital exclusion. Speaking at a people overview and scrutiny meeting on Wednesday, Natalie McFall, Director of Care and Wellbeing at Shropshire Council, said the authority is facing many challenges. "Technology is an area that doesn't work for everybody and doesn't work all the time," she said. "We do annual reviews where we look at people's changing needs." A spokesperson for the NHS Shropshire, Telford and Wrekin, said, "Digital inclusion is a key priority for our integrated care system in Shropshire, Telford and Wrekin."
A woman who founded one of the largest UK wildlife rescue charities is giving a talk on her remarkable journey. Megan Morris-Jones founded Kuan Wildlife Rescue in 1990. More than 35 years on, and the charity rehabilitates and releases more than 6,000 sick, injured and orphaned wild animals and birds each year from its base near Much Wenlock. Now, to raise funds for the charity, Megan is hosting an evening talk explaining her personal journey. A spokesperson for Kuan Wildlife Rescue said, "Join us for a moving and inspiring evening with Megan Morris-Jones, the heart and vision behind Kuan Wildlife Rescue." Having been the only girl attending a boys' boarding school, Megan learned early what it meant to stand up for herself, persevere and stay true to her passions. Those experiences shaped a lifelong commitment to giving a voice to the vulnerable, especially animals who cannot speak for themselves. Her story is sometimes sad, often humorous, and always deeply emotional. A journey of challenges, triumphs, and unforgettable encounters with wildlife. Hear first-hand stories from her remarkable life journey. Find out what shaped this remarkable woman to create one of the UK's largest wildlife rescue charities. Megan's talk takes place on January the 9th next year, at 7:30 p.m. at the Edge Arts Centre, Farley Road, Much Wenlock. All proceeds from the evening will support the ongoing rescue and rehabilitation of injured and orphaned wildlife. Tickets are £15, OAPs and concessions £12. Group discounts are available. Tickets via ticketsource.co.uk.
Dame Agatha Christie's detectives Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple have joined the Mr. Men and Little Miss Universe in the new series of collaborations. The fictional characters have appeared as illustrations in the beloved children's book series to retell and reimagine some of the best-selling novelist's most famous stories. Two of the books, Little Miss Marple, Muddle at the Vicarage, and Monsieur Poirot, Mischief on the Nile, adapted from Dame Agatha's Murder at the Vicarage and Death on the Nile, were published today, with a further two due to hit the shelves in February next year. Originally created by the cartoonist Roger Hargreaves in 1971, the Mr. Men and Little Miss series have been continued by his son, Adam, who took over the family business age 25 following his father's death. Adam said, "It's been a real pleasure and an intriguing challenge to bring together the timeless mystery of Agatha Christie with the playful world of Mr. Men and Little Miss." Agatha Christie's iconic stories have now got a new twist that neither she nor my father might have imagined.
Track 5. Just to remind you that you're listening to East Shropshire Talking Newspaper, edition number 1682. And we now come to part 2 of this edition, which consists of items of a general and interesting nature. Now, some years ago, I belonged to a group of players based in the Belfry Theatre in Wellington. I appeared in one of their plays, which, if I remember correctly, was a play based on a story from Roman times. I played one of the warriors and wore a tunic which showed off my legs. I vividly remember my wife looking at my legs on stage and laughing as I was treading the boards. We did have a script to learn, of course, for the play, which I found not too difficult to learn. I simply cannot imagine, though, what it must be like for a blind actor to appear on stage in a play. How on earth could they even learn the lines, let alone remember them? One such person who manages to do all this with ease is a blind actor called Alex Bulmer. From TNF Soundings, Tim Pennig interviews this remarkable lady.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
The new Wolsey Theatre in Ipswich has an impressive record of inclusivity, providing audio description, BSL and captioning for a number of its productions. The theatre is also inclusive in its readiness to employ disabled actors, and the upcoming production of Don't Look Now includes a totally blind cast member. Alex Bulmer has more than 30 years' experience, including writing and performing in radio drama and film, as well as live theatre. She kindly agreed to talk to us about her career and about her experiences of sight loss, and we recorded this interview in the company of Alex's guide dog, Brody, who you may be able to hear panting quietly in the background. I started by asking Alex which had come first, her desire to be an actor or problems with her sight.
They were almost completely at the same time. I was in second year university in my very first production where I had an actual part as opposed to just the background. And it was, yes, it was October of that year. I was in Quebec at university and I went back to Toronto for an eye appointment at a hospital in Toronto because I was having difficulty seeing at night, and I was falling downstairs, and I was having trouble getting on and off stage. Anyways, I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa. So they really completely coincided. It had always been my intention to pursue acting as a career, but I didn't really start until right at the time that I found out I was going to lose my sight.
So, and it didn't put you off?
For 2 weeks it did. Yeah. I mean, I will say the truth is that the eye doctor who diagnosed me asked me what my future plans were. And when I told her what I wanted to do, she said, "Nobody wants to see a blind woman tripping across the stage."
Oh, dear.
Yes. One of those classic, horrible things to hear. I knew of no blind actors in Canada. I didn't really know of any disabled actors. I didn't know how I would do it, but I did think, I guess it's not a very good idea. So for 2 weeks, I transferred out of my major into, I think I started, I was going to go into psychology full time, which would have been great. But yeah. After 2 weeks, my drama teacher, who was fantastic, took me for a walk. And he said, well, yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah. Give up your dreams. Yeah, go ahead. And it was amazing because he just said, no, you just have to, you'll do it. You'll be fine. And in that production, he put a little coal miner's light on my head, like they use cross-country skiing at night.
Oh, right, yeah.
And turned my character into a firefly fairy, because I was a fairy in Midsummer Night's Dream. And he introduced me to a voice teacher, and I discovered there was this profession of becoming a voice teacher for actors, so you could stay in the field and become an expert in voice. So I did that as well. I went on to train, which is what brought me to the UK. I came to the UK and studied voice at Central School of Speech and Drama, and the rest is kind of history. I never left the profession.
How do individual production, how do they adjust to having a blind actor on the stage?
You know, it really depends, I suppose, but it depends on, it's done slightly differently in different countries. So in this country, as you know, Tim, there's something called Access to Work.
Yeah.
Access to Work has paid for me to have support people in the room with me in rehearsal, which is incredibly helpful in terms of orientation and having lines fed to me and working on the script. By fed, I mean like they're read into a little microphone that, and I wear an earbud in my ear when I'm rehearsing. But, you know, in terms of on stage, and it's the same in Canada as it is here, we work it out. Like, there's tactile markers on the set that are painted the same color as the flooring, so they can't necessarily be seen. Or if they're seen, they're designed into the design of the set, so it becomes part of the set design, these, you know, different kind of tactile floorings. And I use that a lot when I'm on stage on my own. I've been in productions where I've had a support person off stage watching me, and I have an earbud in my ear, and they give me occasional directions in my ear if I need to change directions on stage. And in this particular production, Don't Look Now, I have a twin sister who basically is always with me on stage. Right. So it really just depends, you know, on the production.
Do you learn most of your lines from a recording then, or from a speech synthesizer on your laptop, or how does that work?
I use JAWS.
Yeah, yes, I do.
And I find that really useful in terms of learning lines. I've done that especially for auditions. I'll put an earbud in my ear, plug it into my computer. Yeah. And, you know, you get really good at it. You get really good at listening and talking at the same time. It's a skill, but you can develop that fairly quickly.
And what about the current production, and how do you find... Because the Wolsey's got some, you know, it's quite small and constricted. We had a backstage tour, and I mean, I wonder if there are any specific issues about getting through around that kind of theatre.
I mean, there probably will be. I haven't spent a lot of time backstage yet. We're in the rehearsal hall at the moment. Most backstages of theatres have hazards, for sure, tripping hazards. Yeah. So the chances, I think in this production, someone from the stage management team is going to be backstage with me so that there's always somebody there. I rarely try and manage a backstage space on my own because there's so much going on. Stuff can move on and off stage.
Well, and you've got to learn lots of new places when you move on from one place to the next.
That's right. You've got enough to worry about.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I did a production of Romeo and Juliet in Ontario a couple of years ago at the Stratford Festival, and they put down small ropes in the backstage area from my dressing room to the actual where the stage was, and so that I could use my cane to just trace the bit of rope down the hallways. So that can be helpful.
And what happens to your dog then when you're on stage?
Well, he's three. He's been... Let me see. Is this the first time he's been... I think this might be his first experience while I'm on stage, because he's been with me while I've directed something. He's been with me on a film set.
Yeah.
He will be either in my dressing room with somebody so that he's not alone. I don't like to leave my dog alone in an unfamiliar place. Like, in a familiar place, fine, but not in an unfamiliar place. So he will have somebody with him. And probably be in my dressing room, is my guess. But he, Yeah, he was on a film set with me, and he was great. He sat with the, I think it was the costume director. So I always just make sure that he's looked after. And I'm trying to think if he's had a stage debut yet. No, he has not.
So you do films as well as acting on stage?
Yes.
So how does that work out?
I have to say it's way easier to be on a film set. You know, partly because, and this happened when I was just shooting the film that I was shooting last May, if for some reason I'm not convinced that I'm facing the right way, I just say, am I facing the right way? Because like the camera isn't rolling the whole time.
Yeah.
It's a much better environment for blind actors. And I've heard this from other blind actors. Some have said that they just won't do theater productions anymore because it's too stressful. And it can be really stressful. I said yes to this specifically because there was a sister written into the play that would be with me the whole time. Yeah. And I know the reputation of the new Woolsey, and I'd heard great things about the director, so I knew I was in good hands, but that's not always the case.
What are your plans for the future?
Yeah. Well, interesting on your question about film, I'm probably going to focus more now after this production, pushing more for film, television, and voiceover work. Again, because there's like new advancements in technology, which can enable me to listen and speak at the same time, you know, voiceover work was never an option in the past, often because a lot of voiceover work was also, especially with animation, you used to have to look at the screen and time your delivery to the way the animation was going. So you had to like do it in time with the facial expressions. Yeah. But voiceover work is done so differently these days, and they can slow voices up and speed them up and slow them down. And so the whole voice industry has opened up for blind actors in a way that it never used to. And I'm told that there's more opportunity in this country for blind actors to do audiobooks, which is really not the case at all in Canada, which is where I'm from. So I'm hoping to do more of that.
So how do you know, I mean, are there lots of blind actors about?
In this country, I would say, well, compared to Canada, in this country, there's loads. I think the UK has more blind actors than any other country that I know of. I mean, probably because I've been in the profession and because I've worked a lot within disability theater in this country, I'm more aware of the community of blind actors. And I think there's a strong community in this country. Extant theater has done a lot to develop blind performance and blind theatre. Extant is the UK's leading blind theatre company, and they've been around since like 1997 or something like that. Grey Eye Theatre Company, which is a disabled theatre company. But there's definitely more of us. You know, when I started here, when I came over for the first time in 1990, I met two blind actors. And for me, that was like, you know, wow, because there was no one in Canada. And now I've lost count.
Yeah.
The nice thing is, like, I'm certainly not the only one. And, you know, I've got competition. There's, like, a number of blind actors around my age, and women, and certainly some great actors who are, you know, span the ages of 20 to 65.
Yeah, brilliant.
And hopefully more to come, I think.
Yeah.
I think as technology advances, also television, you know, they're... scripts are being written. People are imagining blind characters in the scripts. Yeah. That's going to make a big difference. And producers are realizing that they have to coordinate schedules and budgets to make sure that access is taken care of. You know, that's a big part of it, is people remembering that accessibility has to be part of the production agenda. So that's getting better as well.
Don't Look Now runs at the new Woolsey Theatre in Ipswich from Thursday the 9th to Saturday the 25th of October, and you can book tickets by calling their box office on 01473 295 900. Don't forget to let the box office know if you are visually impaired and require audio description, and or the support of a sighted friend or companion who can attend free of charge. The following synopsis has been received from the new Woolsey. When grieving couple John and Laura return to Venice, they hope to rekindle happier memories of their honeymoon. But as the nights draw in, so does a sinister figure lurking in the shadows. Some warnings should never be ignored. Eerie visions take hold, and the line between the living and the dead begins to blur. Fate is closing in. Can they escape what's already destined? And the phone number again for booking tickets is 01473 295 900.
TNS Soundings.
Track 6. I received a phone call from my sister-in-law a few weeks ago, who lives just down the road from where I live, to say there was a hedgehog lying on her front lawn with an injured back leg. Could I help out? Well, I jumped into my car and went to see what I could do to help. The local vet was not able to offer their service due to a full occupancy, and so they suggested we take the injured animal to the Kwan Wildlife Centre in Much Wenlock. I gently picked up the injured hedgehog, which I christened Henry, and placed it in a cardboard box to take to Much Wenlock along with my sister-in-law. We both handed Henry over to the specialist team at the centre and asked them to do what they could to help this poor creature. A couple of days later, I phoned the centre to find out if they had managed to help the injured hedgehog. Sadly, I was told they had not been able to help and had to euthanise the hedgehog. I was sorry to hear this news, but thanked the staff for doing their best. I was so impressed with the way the centre operated that they agreed for me to visit the centre in order to interview the staff to discover what happens behind the scenes, so to speak. This is part one of my interview, and parts two and three will follow on later editions of the ESTN. I had a particular reason to visit the Kwan Wildlife Reserve Centre for Sick Animals in Much Wenlock a short time ago, and found the visit so interesting that I arranged to go back later to see what goes on behind the scenes. I started off in reception. The lovely receptionist here is a lady called Liz.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And how's your day going so far?
Very busy.
What sort of animals have you had in today, or creatures, should I say?
So far today, we've had a crow, we've had some hedgehogs, a goldfinch, a few wood pigeon, and a collared dove.
So is that about the norm?
It's slowing down a bit during the start of the summer.
And people are very grateful that you are able to take in these creatures.
Yes, of course, we cover quite a large area.
And are you able to rehabilitate any of them or some of these?
A lot of them get rehabilitated and released.
Next, I was introduced to Deb Fielden, who is the Volunteer Student Coordinator. Right, tell me something about the Wildlife Centre here. What does it do?
We are a wildlife rescue and we basically do what it says. We rescue, we rehabilitate, and in as many cases as possible, we release any kind of British wildlife. So rescue, rehabilitate, and release.
You are a registered charity, I believe.
Yes. Started back in the 1980s, not in Much Wenlock at all. Our founder is an incredible lady called Megan Morris-Jones, and she was living up on an island off the west coast of Scotland called Lyng with her husband and baby daughter Anna. They as a family were very involved with the RSPB and used to carry out perimeter surveys of the island looking for injured and dead seabirds. One day Megan came across an injured bird called a Manx shearwater and picked it up and thought to herself, I wonder if I can do anything for this bird to mean that it could be re-released back into the wild. And that's how we started, right back in the 1980s off the west coast of Scotland.
I believe you have some charity shops as well that help you. Where are those?
We have two charity shops, one actually in the town of Much Wenlock on the High Street, and the second one in Shrewsbury that's not been there quite as long. That's Anna, who is Megan's daughter, who's just come in and fiddled with the safe.
I see. Megan was the lady who started it on.
Yeah, so Megan's still very much around. She does lots of talks for us and still goes out and rescues, but she's handed over management of the charity to her daughter, Ella, who's the one that just popped in.
Wildlife covers a lot of species. Tell me, what species do you cater for, basically?
We cater for any type of British wildlife. There's nothing that we would turn away as long as it is British and it is wildlife. So any type of animal or bird, big or small, there's nothing that we would turn away. There are certain species that we are, by law, not allowed to rehabilitate and release that are on a list of what's called invasive species. The two most common species on that list that we come into contact with are grey squirrels and muntjac deer, and we're not allowed to rehabilitate and, or most importantly, release either of those species. But those are the only two. Apart from that, any kind of British wildlife can turn up on our doorstep.
Now, the reason I'm here today is the fact that my sister-in-law found a wounded hedgehog in a front garden. We live in Wellington. I went to the local vets and they said, "I'm sorry, we can't help." They recommended me to come to you. So we brought this poor little hedgehog in the car. We christened him Henry. I assume it was a he.
Right.
He got a very wounded back leg. I handed him over to your good sounds. Mm-hmm. I did ring up the following day, and unfortunately, he wasn't well enough. You couldn't do anything for him.
Okay.
So we did our good deed.
You did. He certainly did. He did exactly the right thing. He would have been in a terrible amount of pain if, as you say, he got a badly wounded back leg. It's never an easy decision if we have to put an animal or a bird to sleep. But if there is nothing that we can do to make sure that that bird or animal would be able to be re-released back into the wild and thrive, that is the course of action that we would take, and it would have no longer been in suffering. So you did the right thing to bring it to us.
Now, if anybody has any, say, a deer that is damaged, they obviously can't bring it in the car themselves. How do they get it to you?
They would ring us. And as long as we have the staff resources here to go out to it, we have two Q&A vans. And if it was a deer, we would take out the large van with at least two members of staff and bring it in ourselves. Unless the person who'd found it had got some way of getting it to us, but it's very unlikely with a deer. Usually we go out to a deer and bring it in. What I do say to anybody that I show around here, because I manage all the volunteers here, so I'm quite often showing around new people who want to come and volunteer here. And what I do say to them is, you see the very best of humanity here and you see the very worst of humanity. So you meet members of the public who have travelled hours here with a tiny sparrow nestling because they can't bear the thought that that bird won't be given a second chance. The very best of humanity. But we also have animals and birds admitted as a result of human cruelty. You know, they've been shot, they've been poisoned, they've been caught in illegal traps. So we see both ends of the human spectrum here. Lots and lots of feel-good stories, you know, animals and birds that come in and we, between us, think, right, that's not going to last a night. We'll just make it as comfortable as possible with pain relief. And you come in the next morning and it's made a miraculous recovery and we can do something to make sure that it can be released. But again, we have heartbreaking stories. We have animals brought in with horrific injuries that have been inflicted by humans. Or we have animals or birds that we've had here for quite a while. And although we're very, very a hands-off approach, we don't get attached to our animals and birds. We need them to remain wild. If you've had something here for a few weeks, you undoubtedly do feel some kind of attachment to it. And then at the end of the day, if we decide that either, you know, that animal or bird can't be rehabilitated to the stage where we can re-release it and we have to put it to sleep, that's a very, very hard decision. And then we all lean on each other and sort of get ourselves through it together. So it's a permanent emotional roller coaster here, really.
But you do a splendid job.
Thank you.
Track 7. Here at ESTN, we get involved with other charities, and one such is the Macular Society. Like all charities, getting volunteer staff can be a problem. Peter White from Radio 4's In Touch programme has been talking to the CEO of the charity to find out what the future might hold for the Macular Society.
For almost 40 years now, the Macular Society has been the voice of hundreds of thousands of people living with the most prevalent eye disease amongst adults in the UK, particularly found amongst people as they grow older. Back in the 1980s, the Society's founder, Elizabeth Thomas, was shocked at the lack of support these people received and the lack of knowledge about the condition. Since then, the organisation has grown along with the size of the problem and has also become a campaigner for improved treatment and care whilst maintaining its commitment to offering personal support in the community. Just over a year ago, the Society's CEO for the past decade, Kathy Yelf, retired and was succeeded by Ed Holloway. We talked to Ed earlier this year, and this is how he set out his vision.
In some ways, it's fantastic following on from a CEO who's done such a wonderful job because it means the organisation's in great shape. So we've seen really significant growth in our research expenditure over a number of years, and I'd like to see that continue. What we want to be doing as an organisation is focusing more on the clinical research and the, you know, eventually clinical trials, which hopefully can bring new treatments to bear against the condition. And then the other is growth in terms of the people that we're supporting.
But it now seems that the new broom is sweeping rather too clean for a number of the members and at least some of the staff. It was triggered by an email to staff at the end of March warning that some redundancies were going to be inevitable and that there would be a consultation period about forthcoming plans for the society. Well, judging by emails that we've been receiving, those changes aren't going down well, and we've been seeking an interview with Ed Holloway for some months, which we were told couldn't happen while the consultation was taking place. Well, now I'm glad to say we can talk to the CEO about forthcoming plans. Welcome back to In Touch, Ed. I think it would be helpful for you to hear what people have been saying to us, because they made it very clear the questions they want me to ask you.
The Macular Society helps visually impaired people in three ways: through sponsoring research into macular disease, through its telephone helplines and newspaper, and supporting around 400 volunteer-led groups all over the country. These groups provide friendship, information and peer support for thousands of people, many of whom cannot reach the sight loss charities, and many of whom are in despair as they find their sight failing, often quite rapidly. But the Macular Society is considering cutting down to two, the team of 17 regional managers, in order to save £500,000. But it would totally undermine the groups and probably result in a fairly rapid closure of many, if not most of them. I know there is a central volunteer support team, but this is not enough to keep a network of volunteer leaders going.
I've been a member since the 1990s, and like so many others, I'm very angry about what they're doing. It used to be that the Board of Trustees had to have a large majority of people with macula, but over the years this has been changed. So now the majority are eye care professionals. The Society's main concern used to be providing services to support people with macula, and they did it extremely well. But there is now a change of emphasis, so the professionals want more money to go into research. But there are many thousands of members who will never be helped by research and need support now.
The Macular Society has been advising their regional managers that their jobs are under review. Some have been told not to organise anything beyond the current month. While this may not technically be making people redundant, it has the effect of making people look at other positions should they come up. Inevitably, many of them have already resigned their positions. In their place, the MS is appointing voluntary, part-time workers in the hope that they will maintain the local infrastructure. How a part-time volunteer can organise speakers, events, and give accurate advice to a very needy group is unknown.
Well, that last email you heard was from Donald Cameron, OBE, a retired optometrist, and before that, from members Anna Baldwin and Pauline Chapman. Ed Holloway, a lot of anger and strong feeling there, and I can assure you that this is only a sample of what we've been hearing. Can we start with the issue of regional managers that you're planning to dispense with, you know, given that sense of how valuable they are to macular disease sufferers? Why are you doing this?
And the first thing to say is we really do value the work of our volunteer-led groups. I think they do fantastic work in their community to support people living with macular disease, and we absolutely want to see that continue. Contrary to some of the comments in those emails, we're not proposing to simply do away with a team. What we're proposing to do under a consultation process is reduce the size of our current regional team. It's currently got about 24 people in, and we're talking about reducing that to around 14 people, although those changes are still subject to a consultation period.
But why are you doing that? Because that would surely weaken it. Is this about money? Because looking at the society's finances over the past 4 or 5 years, it doesn't look as if you need to do this for financial reasons. You know, for example, in the last financial year, you only spent a little more than you had coming in, and there are plenty of ways such a deficit could have been dealt with.
So part of this is about financial sustainability, and obviously 1 year's annual accounts only tells a picture for 1 year. So like lots of organisations, we are facing rising costs. For example, the Chancellor's decision to increase national insurance payments for employers is having a real impact on our finances. So part of this is about financial sustainability, but this is also about working more effectively. And our focus as an organisation is on beating macular disease. And that means we always need to make sure we're working in the most effective way possible.
I mean, you heard there from members, Ed. I think there's been quite a lot of pushback about this from staff too. That's true, isn't it? I'm sorry, I've heard the word toxic mentioned about the kind of mood there is at the moment.
So change is difficult, and change of this nature within organisations can often be a challenging process. As I say, the consultation process is ongoing. We're listening to feedback and we'll be making final decisions in the coming weeks and months.
So what is the plan? What's the overall plan and how does it differ from what you were doing before?
So in terms of the regional team, as I say, the final decisions haven't been made, but currently that team's got about 24 people in, and under our proposals, it would reduce to 14. So it's still the largest team within the organisation, and we're confident that that's enough resource to provide really high quality support to our volunteers. Whereas at the moment it is an entirely regional team, that would involve more central support. And what that means is we can create some new roles, for example, focused on volunteer communication or learning and development or recruiting volunteers. So we think that that team can work more effectively and continue to enable our local groups to thrive. That sits alongside our wider work as an organisation, and that balance between funding the world-class research to find a cure and providing day-to-day support. And it's important to note that our local groups are just one part of the support that we provide. We also have a helpline, a counselling service, befriending and practical support for people living with macular disease.
I will come on to the issue of the research and the search for a cure, but these consultations, are they really consultations? The RNIB went through a similar process a few months back, and people who put forward alternative plans felt they weren't taken seriously. We've been hearing the same from some of your staff. They're done deals, aren't they, these consultations? You have a plan, you then have a consultation, and then you carry on with the plan you'd always intended to do.
No, absolutely not. We're listening really hard to feedback from staff and from volunteers, and we're committed to making the best possible decisions we can. And obviously, as an organisation, we need to exist in the financial reality we have. So I talked about rising costs for the organisation. We do need to find a way to address those. But the final decisions we take will absolutely be shaped by the feedback that we receive.
Let's talk about money for research, because you've raised it several times, and this is obviously important. Nobody denies the need for research or that the long-term solution to conditions like macular disease is a cure, with better drugs, better treatments, greater priority within the NHS. But is that really the responsibility of a members group like yours, which is a relatively, in terms of charities, a relatively, well, medium-sized, if not small? Is that really something that you can have a major effect on?
I think it is something we can have a major effect on. And what we're seeing is our role as leading the research agenda in macular disease and bringing together researchers to really focus on the priorities of people living with macular disease. And what we do hear consistently from people with macular disease is that they want us to keep that balance. They want us to fund research. They also want us to provide support day to day. And we're absolutely going to continue that balance and continue that breadth of activity.
But what our listeners have been saying, and what your own members are saying to us, is there are a lot of people out there who just need this help now.
Absolutely. I think there are people who need our support here today, and some of that is provided for our local groups, and we want to see them continue to flourish and to increase their reach. And some of that is through our other services, such as our helpline, our counselling and our befriending service. And we want to build all of our work so that we really increase our reach and impact as an organisation.
The listeners you heard there, your members, doubt whether you can really give that individual help centrally as effectively as it can be done on the ground, regionally, face to face, not on the phone, not online. Would you not accept that this kind of help needs to be on a very personal, individual basis?
So lots of our support to our volunteers is already delivered on the phone or via email or online with a team of 24 staff covering the whole country, as you can imagine. Their ability to meet face to face with an individual group, they do that, but it's not on a daily or even a weekly basis. So we're already providing lots of support to our volunteers remotely. We really do believe that we can give our volunteers the support that they need through a range of different mechanisms. There will still be some face-to-face contact. It will, of course, change if we go ahead with these proposals, but we do think we will be able to provide our volunteers with the support that they need.
Just to be clear, Ed, does that mean that the consultation is still on?
Yes.
Because the sense was that you couldn't really talk about it until the consultation is over. So, I mean, clearly the kind of people who got in touch with us wanted to express views so that you would hear them. Is there a chance that these views could still be taken seriously and could bring about change?
So the consultation process is ongoing. We have hoped that it would have concluded by now, but it's taken a little bit longer than we'd hoped.
Is that because people don't like it?
It's because we want to make sure we're listening to everyone's views and really making the right decisions for the organisation and for people living with macular disease. So, yeah, the consultation process is still ongoing and we haven't made any final decisions.
How long do you think it will take before you can say exactly what you are going to do?
It's difficult to give a firm date because it depends on, you know, when we're able to have all of the discussions that we want to have. But I do appreciate uncertainty is challenging, so we want to make final decisions as quickly as we can.
Ed Holloway, thank you very much indeed for coming on.
Thank you.
Track 8. It's not often that we get the opportunity to see a heron in the wild. This bird symbolises a variety of traits, including patience, custom and adaptability, stemming from its watchful and still nature. In some folklore, a heron or its feather is considered a sign of good luck. In certain American cultures, herons represent renewal, rejuvenation, and rebirth. Mavis Gulliver has written an article about these mystic birds, and Steve Bristow from WSTN is now going to read it for us.
If you've never seen a heron, try to imagine a long-legged, long-necked bird. If he stretches to his full height, his head reaches the average door handle. But when he tucks his neck into the hunch of his shoulders, he looks like a different bird altogether. His legs, often hidden in vegetation or underwater, are yellow, except in the breeding season when, like his long yellow bill, they take on an orange hue. His feet have four toes, three facing forward and one facing back. They enable him to wade through water and to walk on soft ground without sinking in. Although I've rarely seen their feet, I gained a good idea of their size when I came across footprints on a beach in winter. Snow fell all night, covered the beach, waited for the world to wake and make its mark. A heron penned perfect prints, long toes leading to the grey sea's edge, patterns in snow, transient as thought, needing only a burst of sun to erase their poetry. Herons are generally seen near water, standing stock still beside the sea, alongside meres, rivers, brooks and canals, and even in gardens with well-stocked fish ponds. Their unmoving stance and keen vision enable them to spot their prey of fish, eels, amphibians, insects, worms, small mammals, and even newly hatched ducklings. The thing that I find most fascinating about herons is their choice of nesting site. Somehow their implausibly long legs enable them not only to balance, but to build their nests in trees. And for a bird that's usually seen alone, it's surprising that they choose to nest close together. In Shropshire, the best place to see a heronry is at Ellesmere. Just offshore lies a man-made island, created from soil and rubble, excavated during the creation of Ellesmere House Gardens. Named Moscow Island because it was completed in 1812, when Napoleon was defeated in Moscow, it is the site of a large heronry. For over 40 years, it has provided a safe sanctuary for around 30 pairs of nesting herons. In February, they return to the island to repair, rebuild, or construct their nests. These rather untidy platforms of twigs and small branches can measure as much as a metre in both height and diameter. The female lays her eggs in May, and within a month the chicks emerge. Fed by both parents, they grow rapidly, and after about 6 weeks they're ready to find their own way in the world. Overlooking Moscow Island, the Boathouse Restaurant and Visitor Centre provide a perfect opportunity to find out more about these enigmatic birds. High-tech, live-feed cameras focus on nests and give close-up views of the day-to-day happenings. A volunteer is often on hand to answer questions, and you can sit in the restaurant to enjoy a meal while you watch the comings and goings of the adult herons. Even more appealing are views of the chicks with their downy heads and large gaping beaks. In our increasingly busy world, there's growing interest in mindfulness, the desire to feel in the moment, to leave stress and anxiety behind by focusing on the here and now. The heron, in his stillness, is not asleep. He is mindful, alert to everything around him, a perfect example to follow.
Track 9. I have always admired people who have the capacity to write poetry. What inspires them to write special words in a special order and create feelings, emotions, word pictures into the minds of the people who are reading the poems? Recently I met a lovely lady who has the ability to write such poetry. I visited her along with my recording equipment to record her saying her compositions. Her name is Edna Groom, and we are now going to hear a poem she has written entitled The Charity Shop. Edna is a special lady who has reached the magic age of 100 years, but when you listen to her, she sounds much, much younger than her age.
Hooray and three cheers for the shop volunteers. They greet every day with a smile. With their cheery hello, as they very well know, there'll be goods coming in all the while. When they get to the door, plastic bags on the floor, they roll up their sleeves and get cracking. For it's working not stop in a charity shop, ironing, salting and unpacking. Tape measure in hand to measure waistband, check all garments for size, test all the zips, press studs and the clips, nothing escapes their keen eyes. There is tea sets and dishes, handbags and shoes, some for everyday wear and for some for posh do's, pictures and books, thing hang upon crooks, puzzles, pencils and toys. Someone has found, while looking around, a whistle that makes a loud noise. A cry from the fitting room, please come and see, I'm stuck in a dress that's too tight for me. Oh dearie me, where's the kettle to tea? I hope it hasn't been sold. Look over there, even under the chair, could be anywhere, so I am told. Kettle now found, after good look around, and at last the floor you can see. Moved clothes here and there and found empty chair, then have a nice cup of tea. Hooray and three cheers for the shop volunteers, as homeward they go on their way. They've done of their best, and no need of rest. Oh, what an interesting day.
Track 10. Well, time has run out, I'm afraid, and we have come to the end of this recording. I'd like to thank all who have been involved, including Eve Saunders, Guy King, Tim Pennick, Peter White, Steve Bristow from WSTN, Edna Groom, and not forgetting Alan Snell, our recording engineer. We always look forward to hearing from you with any comments you might have. Our phone number is 01952 373 007. That's 373 007. And our answer machine is constantly monitored. And if you want to send a message, our address is eastshropshiretn@gmail.com. Could I also make another gentle reminder for you to return any memory sticks once you have listened to them? And one further point here is to ask you not to take your pouches to a post office, as for some reason they delight in sticking a label on our pouches. They are very difficult to remove, and so please do simply push the pouches into a good old-fashioned postbox. Lighting up time is 4:50 p.m. That's 10 to 5, and next week your presenter will be Simon Martin. Until I'm back with you, this is me, Robert, saying thanks for listening, and bye for now.